Accession number 18802, reel 12.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 12.
Am I okay to go? Speaking very generally about that time in Malaya, I mean, in round figures, we were there for 18 months. And in round figures, my company, and it was, from a company commander's point of view, it was wonderful because we were split up in company groups. We had various sort of bits and pieces attached to us. Necessary some mortars, and if necessary, extra signalers, and so on. And so, as I said, we went to Kajang, first of all, my company, where we were grouped with B Company, in fact. And I then went up to Slim River in Para, which is a completely different sort of countryside. And then I finished up for my final 6 months near Gemas. There was a little camp on the roadside called Sungi Dua, and indeed that's where we took the late Duke of Gloucester into the jungle, just to sort of show him what we were up to. But we come to that in due course of time, later in, well, in fact, in 1956. No, 57. When indeed he arrived to, on behalf of the Queen, to give Malaya independence, and it then became Malaysia.
I should ask you if you were also trained to deal with any particular hazards to health and hygiene living in jungle conditions. You mentioned the necessity of having something dry for overnight and having bashes for shelter.
I always forget what the various names of these anti-malaria things are. They vary between paludrine, mepocrine, and various other things. I think we were on paludrine then, if I remember. Indeed, we took those every day, and that was obligatory. You had to take those every day. Water, obviously, was a problem in the jungle, and so we had water purifying tablets with us the whole time. One of the other things, which is probably not common knowledge, is every platoon, when it went out, carried a water bottle full of rum with it.
Oh. What was that for?
It was for, let's call it morale, medicinal, or whatever purposes you like. And indeed, I've no doubt every platoon varied slightly in the way it did these things, but I remember one platoon in particular that I was out with for several days. And we did a stand to at night, we did a stand to in the morning, and the platoon commander went round, his platoon sergeant went round, and they had a series of questions that they asked each individual soldier at the stand to. And as part and parcel of that drill, each soldier was offered sort of about that much of rum, and in the top of a water bottle. They could refuse it if they didn't want it, but most of them accepted it as being something that was a warmer and helped you to sleep. I regard it as very important, actually, as a part of the daily ration.
An element of comfort.
Yes, very important.
It's evident that you enjoyed the activity at Kajang. What was the situation when you got to Kajang?
I can't tell you in detail what the overall situation throughout Malaya was.
No, but I'm thinking about in your area of responsibility.
In that particular area, we knew that there were various terrorists about.
Yeah.
And indeed, one of the fascinating things about that particular 6 months was we did a lot of ambushing based on special branch information, and that perhaps is one of the techniques that although we'd read about it and practiced it to an extent in our training getting ready for Malaya, it wasn't till we actually realized what we'd got to do that we realized how difficult it was to ambush properly. in a foreign land where you stood out like a sore thumb against the locals, and therefore if you wished to have a successful ambush, you had to be completely hidden for however long your ambush was in position. And usually that more than 3 days really wasn't a feasibility. And so we set out to do an ambush for 3 days, and we equipped a platoon to go off and do it, very carefully briefed. I probably dropped bits of it off from a private car rather than going in a military vehicle. And I can only say, and it's going back to the versatility of the British soldier, I can only say that there was one ambush we put in on Special Branch advice, which was there for 3 days and three nights, came out. There had been complete radio silence, of course, while all this was going on. And they came out to report that indeed the target had arrived, but the target had come from a different direction from that expected and briefed, and that from the location of the individual bits of the ambush, they had decided that they could not guarantee a kill, and rather than give the ambush position away, they did nothing.
Was that the right thing to do?
Very interesting question, very difficult decision for the guy on the spot to make. I thought it probably was the right thing to do. However, we had the Special Branch man in and said, you know, terribly sorry and all that, but we just cocked it up, if that's the right description. We just weren't good enough to do it. And he said, don't worry about that at all, and don't worry about not being good enough. I can tell you that nobody knows that ambush was there. And furthermore, it can go back on another occasion. And, you know, it'll be successful. Or if the chap comes, if he doesn't, well, too bad. And, oh, I suppose about a fortnight later, we put that ambush back in exactly the same place. And on that occasion, the chap didn't come. And so the thing, you know, just didn't happen. But well, it was very, very interesting to see the technical skill of these soldiers under extreme difficulty and extreme conditions, being silent and immobile, really, for 3 days. Extraordinary.
How was the commander of the force able to communicate with the other members of the ambush if they were all concealed and immobile, lying up? What system of signals would you have when you were in such ambush positions where stealth was the essential quality?
I don't remember, to be honest, in detail. People were pretty well nearby, of course. I mean, it wasn't an enormously spread area. It was a very concentrated area. To an extent, there'd be sort of, you know, perhaps a bit of string or that sort of signal. I just don't remember. I mean, I think probably the answer was everybody kept jolly quiet until something actually happened, and it didn't matter how much noise you made.
How many men would there be normally deployed in that sort of ambush?
My recollection is that it was about 7 or 8.
So you've got a section out, actually, very
small,
on the ground.
Yeah, very small.
Have you got any idea of how many enemy there were in your tactical area of responsibility?
Not a lot, is the broad answer to that question. I mean, there weren't a lot around. I mean, I should think the total number in the whole of Malaya was under 100, would be my guess. In Kajang, because there were two companies there, and because we were all using the same special branch and the same police backup, we, although the two companies were separate and operated in their own entities, we decided to pool the briefing arrangements. And so the two company commanders alternated, sort of day on or day off, or week on or week off, or whatever it was, to take responsibility for sending out the various patrols from whichever company they were going to come. And it so happens that was a gentleman who was a very senior terrorist called Yong Kuo, who was in our area and special branch, said where he was going to be. And I was happened to be the briefer for the two companies on that occasion. And I briefed the other company to send out a patrol to deal with us. And indeed, they got Yong Kuo. My company was furious that I had briefed the other company to go off and get this very high-ranking terrorist. C'est la guerre.
Well, it encourages a healthy spirit of rivalry, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How big was your area, and what was its what was the terrain like, generally?
I can't remember how big the area was. From the point of view of operations, we more or less chose the jungle. I mean, it has been the most likely place to have a contact. There was one occasion, in fact, when we were told there were terrorists on the Kuala Lumpur golf course, and indeed we trotted off and we did have a contact on the Kuala Lumpur golf course. And I forget now, I think we killed two or three.
That sounds like a major contact in
yes.
the context of Malaya.
Well, it was, and it happened at very short notice, just sort of, you know, suddenly some policeman came in and said, hey, can you produce somebody? And we duly did, and it was successful.
I mean, was most of your area at Kajang covered in jungle? Or
yes.
Was, yeah, so... Were there areas of cultivation or rubber plantations? Or
quite a lot of rubber. And indeed, quite a lot of our work was... and there were various sort of little villages as well, and rubber estates and so on. But, of course, we were there after, I think it was called the Briggs arrangements for 45 villages and things like that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people had been transported into these villages, many cases against their will. And, of course, going out to work in the rubber plantations, they were searched on the way out in the morning and on the way back in the evening. And I suppose that was quite a large part of the ordinary duties of soldiers in that neck of the woods at that particular time. It was a joint police and military thing. And I remember that there was quite a lot of excitement when proper arrangements hadn't been made for searching booths, and in particular booths for the women to be searched in. And I can remember, you know, there was quite a lot of activity on that particular front. People saying, well, look, we absolutely must get this right, otherwise people have a legitimate complaint. And in due course of time, there were proper searching booths and proper female police to run them.
Were they recruited locally, those female searchers?
I suppose, yes. I honestly don't know where they came from.
What were you looking for in the searches?
Food. Food mainly, I would think. To an extent, weapons, of course, or ammunition, but food mainly.
I mean, were the searches fruitful? Did you find
no.
things?
No.
So they were deterrent.
I don't recall ever finding anything. Yeah. But I suppose the fact they were taking place and known to be taking place deterred people from trying to get through, and that, in effect, achieved what it set out to achieve, which was replenishment for people in the jungle.
Were you ever attacked by the terrorists?
No.
You never had a contact initiated by them?
No.
What was the
We were there very late in the day, of course. I mean, the whole thing wound up not long after we'd been there.
How many contacts did you have, roughly, in your time at Kajang? Were they a frequent occurrence? Or?
No. Three, certainly. There may have been one or two other fleeting ones, but I honestly don't remember. But, I mean, to have a contact was a very, very unusual event.
Were the contacts you did have all based upon information from the police? Or
yes.
They were?
Yes.
Because you mentioned the one on the golf course, which was sounds as though it was a piece of good luck, a lucky sighting.
Absolutely
good
luck.
Follow up.
Yeah. Absolute good luck.
And then there was the case with Yong Kuo.
That was information.
That was information.
Yeah.
And then there was information that led to the ambush that wasn't sprung.
Yes.
Yes.
No, the special branch man there had a very high reputation for good information on operational matters.
Have you any idea of how he managed to get it? What his methods of acquisition were?
We had informants, I suppose, like all special branch people around the world. Who they were and how he found them, I've no idea.
Do you remember what his background was, what he'd been doing before he'd turned up at Kajang as head of the special branch?
No. I mean, he was a policeman. Whether he'd always been special branch, I don't know, I'm afraid.
How did you maintain your contacts with him? Did you meet him every day for a formal meeting, or did he contact you when he had something to tell you, or when you had something to tell him?
No, I don't recall there being a formal meeting every day. We obviously had our own briefing sessions every day. If there was something they wanted to talk about, the police, they came to those briefing sessions. I don't remember it being a routine that they should be there. But I think probably that things hadn't been developed quite so closely on the military police tie-up in that area as perhaps happened later on in other places. But certainly, if either side needed a meeting, there was absolutely no problem. I mean, they could be set up at the drop of a hat. If the special branch man wasn't around, well, either somebody came on his behalf, an ordinary policeman came on his behalf, or, sadly, the thing had to wait. But he knew he could always get one of us, always.
What about your relations with the ordinary police as opposed to the special branch?
Perfectly good, not very exciting, if I remember correctly. We dealt with the local police commander and had to, of course, setting up these searches and things like that. And occasionally, if we were doing a search operation, which we would always have police with us for a military operation, and that was set up with the local police. But relations are perfectly good, but I wouldn't say... they certainly weren't as close as my later relations with the head policeman in Londonderry when we were in Northern Ireland. And that was very, very close indeed. But life had moved on by then. I mean, you know, we'd all learnt more. We'd learnt about military police cooperation.
Did you ever have anything to do with locally generated forces, the so-called Home Guard?
Yes, not much. We saw them round about these various guarded villages. The Malay regiment, of course, was around. Occasionally we saw that. I think, I seem to remember we did one joint operation, them and us. But
the Malay regiment?
Yes, it didn't come to anything very much.
How did you get on with them, and what did you think of their performance on that?
I think our feeling was they were rather better than we expected them to be. because very early days in their lives.
So they were competent soldiers?
Yes. Mm. But we didn't see a huge amount of them.
No. What about the local forces, the sort of village militia? What were they up to?
I don't think I can answer that question. I mean, you talked about the Home Guard. I can't even remember what the right name for those forces was. All right, we met them on the outside of villages. We met them for the morning searches and the evening searches and so on. But we didn't really see them doing their business otherwise.
What sort of protection did these villages have?
Minimal, would be my recollection. But they had armed posts round the flanks of the villages.
Were they fenced off?
They were all fenced. Indeed, I wish I could remember the name. There was a technical name for the... Well, they were new villages, or... There was some technical name for them, which implied that they were fenced and that the people had come from whatever part of the jungle they'd come from. And they'd been installed in these areas, as I said earlier, often much against their will. Whether they were a success or not, I don't honestly feel capable to judge.
You mentioned various types of operations. You mentioned ambushes, patrols, and searches. Were there any other sorts of operations that you were doing in an active way at Kajang?
Don't think so, no.
When you were doing patrols, what would be their duration normally? How long would they be out?
Usually about a week. Sometimes a bit longer, in which case they probably had an airdrop in the middle for resupply. Usually about a week.
What would the objective be of patrol when it was going out?
To declare... Either to find some terrorists or to declare an area clear.
Were there any finds?
No. Occasionally there was sort of evidence of, you know, somebody having been there before, but certainly not in the immediate past. But again, rather as you were suggesting earlier on another subject, the fact they were all taking place was a deterrent to people setting up shop and establishing themselves.
What sort of patrol effort were you able to generate? In other words, at any one time, how many patrols would you manage to have out operating?
Well, bearing in mind we're talking of a two-company base.
Yes.
So that's six platoons we're talking about. At any one minute, almost certainly two would be out.
Two platoons?
Or parts of two platoons would be out, almost certainly. Almost certainly one would want to keep probably two in reserve for quick-mounted special branch operations. And so that leaves you two, sort of either out or not out, as the case may be. I would guess that there were usually two or three platoons out.
Would a patrol be carried out by a whole platoon as such, or would you have patrols on a smaller scale?
Varied. It depended how far they were going, how long they were going for. I don't think anything went less than half a platoon.
So that'd be about 15 men.
Well, you see, on the whole, platoons are pretty small by this time. I mean, you're probably lucky if you were more than 25 at the outside.
Ah. So you'd have about a dozen men.
That's getting pretty small, and fine for an ambush, but not so fine for a long-distance patrol. And on the whole, people went out as platoons.
What sort of length would they cover? What distance would they patrol?
I absolutely have no recollection at all. I think we... I think we probably reckoned in terms of time rather than distance in those days.
So they'd be off out for a week or so, and
yes.
then they'd come back.
Yes.
So they'd obviously have to go in a sort of loop, wouldn't they?
Of course, yes.
You mentioned a quick reaction force. If you were required to react quickly, how would you get to wherever it was you were going? Did you have motor transport standing
yes.
by?
Yes. But again, I mean, we got perhaps a bit more professional and the drills were better organised. Again, when I looked to Northern Ireland, where literally, I mean, you had some people's 10 minutes notice, some people at an hour's notice, some people at whatever. Well, in the jungle setup, you couldn't quite operate like that, but the quick reaction was pretty quick.
Were they allowed to take their boots off?
Yes. Yes, it wasn't that quick.
When you were planning a patrol, was that done by you as the company commander, or was it done by platoon commanders? And did you have your area subdivided into platoon areas of responsibility, or was it a sort of general company area?
General company area, and indeed general two company area.
Yes.
And depending on information that had come in, either detailed information, specific information, or rather broad, general sort of information, on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis, the other company commander and I used to have a chat, probably, saying, well, you know, wouldn't it be nice to go and have a look at that area or that area over there? And we'd decide yes or no, probably try it out on the special branch man. And as a result of all that, perhaps in a fortnight's time or a week's time or whatever, you know, patrol would duly head off in that direction from one company or another.
So it would be a sort of joint company commander's decision taken with advice from special branch.
Yes.
And that would determine the area you wanted to...
To look at.
To look at.
Yeah. I mean, occasionally, I suppose, it might well be that the battalion commander had something to say about it. He might want something looked at, in which case, you know, rather obviously we looked at it.
How far away were you from the rest of the battalion?
Well, we were in Kajang. The battalion headquarters was in Kuala Lumpur. There were two companies in Kajang. There was another company. I absolutely forget where it was, but it was quite a long way away. And I suppose Kajang from Kuala Lumpur is 15 miles, something, 20 miles, something of that sort.
So you're quite widely dispersed.
Oh, yes. Okay. And happily so for a company commander.
You were running your own show.
Exactly.
How often did you get visited by the battalion commander?
I suppose certainly once a week. I don't think more often than that, probably.
And what you're saying, you started... Every day you'd have a sort of routine briefing. Was that a morning prayer session, or was it held later in the day? What was the normal routine?
My recollection is it was an evening session.
Ah.
That's my recollection, but that may be wholly wrong. It certainly wasn't a morning prayers thing. You see, again, I go back to Northern Ireland, where quite firmly we had morning prayers every day, and it was morning prayers at a specified time, unless it got altered for operational reasons.
Was this briefing session conducted in a formal manner?
No.
No. What sort of setup did you have for holding and recording and disseminating information? Did you have an ops room of some sort?
We had an ops room, which is a joint ops room, manned by both company headquarters. And I seem to remember we probably had a... We probably lent somebody from battalion headquarters from the intelligence side to sort of keep the maps marked up and so on, but I honestly don't remember in detail. But certainly I don't remember recording of information or dissemination of information. I don't remember it being a problem.
Who would attend your regular evening briefings, besides yourself and the other company commander?
Well, if we were just sort of decision-making, it would be us two,